No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
CJSF 90.1 FM would like to remind listeners that the following program is a repeat broadcast.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and joining me once again is Kale. If you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show for, you know, any amount of time, we certainly appreciate you listening to us. We know that when we sit down to do our shows, it's always a great exercise for us to be able to go out, do the reading, do the research. I know it also is something that many viewers or many listeners have appreciated as well. So it's been a pleasure to do this, but it's also been, you know, something that I personally get something out of as well too. So it's been a great year for going through different texts. I don't know how long ago it was. It was very recent, but we did Henri Bergson. And I thought that was very interesting. It was very short, but that was quite interesting.
Yeah, we read most of the other texts of Bergson's Metaphysics. The structure of the show a lot of times is going through a particular text, or we've had quite a few episodes like the Bergson one where we're doing a kind of multi-day focus or multi-episode focus on one text or one thinker or whatever. And so a lot of those have been a lot of fun. But I also think that as you were pointing out, Brandon, that for me, be as one of the regular hosts of the Canadian Philosophy Show, one of the great things about the show itself is the fact that it becomes an impetus for me to engage in texts like that, right? Because, you know, I have a career and stuff outside of philosophy and academia. It's really important to have something that continues to bring you in to that, to the readings, brings you into the thinking, right? Like, instead of, I mean, I guess, like, and I do just read on my own independently, but it's certainly, I would say that my philosophy consumption, if I could say that, that sounds a little, you know, so maybe it's a little off there, but we'll go with it for now. My philosophy consumption would be much lower than it is currently if it wasn't for the show. And I mean, I know lots of individuals who had took various kinds of arts degrees or whatever, and now that it's, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30 years past their degree and they're in a different career, different life, they don't really spend much time at all with what they studied. And I think that that's a real shame.
Yeah, I actually encountered kind of that idea too, because I did, like, out of school, I did start working also to sort of support myself, as you have to. But I did encounter someone who explicitly said that, you know, we were talking and I told them that I'd studied philosophy and that I was still doing it. He said, well, you know, that's great that you're still doing it, because down the road, most people just drop that stuff. Either they burn out explicitly, like they just, you know, run themselves through some kind of gauntlet. They didn't anticipate that school was really going to, you know, squeeze it all out of them, I guess. And they just don't have it in them to do it anymore. Or they set themselves up, they go through it, and they really do have a passion for it. And school is, you know, university, college, any kind of schooling is really good for structure, right? When you put, you know, the reality is when you put money on the table, you really do have to kind of commit to it in a certain way. And it's good for creating structure and that kind of rhythm that one gets into with school is really good for supporting academic habits. And then when school's over, since you've been building these habits, you know, these reading habits, these study habits around a structured environment like school, and it's gone, well, no wonder they stop doing it. As much as they would love to continue, they just have to stop, right? Because that infrastructure really just isn't there. So I think that that really is one of the things that interests me about that really does excite me about continuing to do this, is that we've kind of extended that a little bit. We've built ourselves something that, you know, doesn't just incentivize it. Well, that's the thing, is you do kind of have to have these little incentive structures, right? I mean, we're so used to thinking that, and it's not foreign to us that, again, you know, the mediums that we construct or embed ourselves in kind of dictate the ways that we're going to be living our lives, right? Like, I know that you and I are, like, as people who read philosophy of media and do kind of media studies, we're keenly aware that we are doing a radio show, right? There's always been a kind of, I don't want to say like irony, but there's always been a kind of, well, maybe it's not ironic, because any kind of form of studying that is going to take some media, right? Whether you're consuming that through a classroom, or you're doing it yourself through a book, or listening it to podcasts, or even promulgating it on a radio show, right? But in any case, it's going to take the shape that you put it in, right? The container that you put that kind of reading in is just going to conform to whatever houses it. And so it's nice that we've had something that we can house it in, because it seems like most people either don't have that or never had it to begin with.
Well, and I hope that what we get out of it, the listeners do as well. And it's been really beneficial for us, because, you know, it's an extra, as you said, it's an extracurricular structure that allows us, you know, gives us an incentive to continue to do this, to make these episodes, to read, to study, to do, you know, have these very like independent, free conversations, and allows us to really pick where we want to go with that. And that sort of flexibility has been a huge blessing within the context of the show, because even at most extracurricular activities don't have that kind of flexibility, even if they are tangentially related to what people maybe previously studied or what they do for work or whatever. The absence of structure isn't always a good thing. I think it's always like, that's obviously going to be contextual. But I think for us in this case, it's very much like we are able, because of this show, to do philosophy and just sort of pick and choose what we want to read, because we think it's interesting and we think it's worthwhile. And it's also stuff that we want to engage with and share with all you listeners out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that goes to the heart. There is a certain kind of, again, like, not paradox. That's the thing about these things. There's always a balance to be struck in education, right? Between the force of the guiding hand, but also the sort of freedom for the student to have taken the hand that guides in a certain way. When you take a class, obviously you're consenting to take that. You submit yourself to whatever reading list or syllabus that is on the table for that class. But in a certain way, once you're there, you're stuck with it. If there's a book you don't want to read, you don't get to read. You know, you can't say no unless you just don't and, like, take a zero, in which case I guess you could do it.
Well, or alternatively, you can find other ways to, you know, effectively avoid doing the reading. And I don't necessarily mean cheating. I mean engaging with very simplified forms of content that'll give you basic information that'll usually allow you to pass. But it's not, as you were saying, that it's an interesting fact of modern, particularly engaged with modern studies and
stuff. Yeah, content that will spare you the encounter, essentially. Yeah, I'm thinking in particular, I mean, I know that in my time like we had things like we obviously they're still here, but like Spark Notes and things like that, where it's like if you just don't care, you can go look up the Spark Notes or whatever for Plato, and I guess you could like get a passing grade for that. The thing that always got beat into my head was any ideas that aren't really your own, but that you're citing, that is plagiarism. So if you're just kind of like, if you're reading Spark Notes and then writing an essay and not saying, hey, like, actually, this isn't coming from, like, these thoughts aren't really coming from me. They're coming from Spark Notes. Even if you're not copy pasting or anything like that, that would still be considered plagiarism. I mean, now it's so much dicier because we have AI, ChatGPT, to produce these things, right? So, like, even for people who go onto ChatGPT and like have a conversation with ChatGPT or something like that, those still aren't really your thoughts. I mean, they kind of are, but at the same time, they're like very rasterized in a way. They're very like processed. They're not yours, but at the same time, you wouldn't have had them unless you had an AI to sort of stretch you across the finishing line in a way. And so there's absolutely like something very suspect about those. But in any case, like I'm going into this just to say that one of the kind of beautiful things about having a show like this is that it's not even just that like I have like something I want to read, like let's bring up Bergson again. Like, oh, I really want to read Bergson, or there's like something interesting about Bergson. I can actually, like, I have the freedom to just kind of take a chance with Bergson that I don't have at university, or that people wouldn't consider themselves to have taking a chance at university. So, like, I find Bergson, and I say this lots on the show, but it's really bears repeating. Like, I found Bergson in a free book pile. You know, a lot of my encounters with texts are just like serendipitous encounters. And I think that's a great way to encounter a text, is to just find it. It kind of finds you in a way. But in any case, I get to just take a chance and say, hey, like, I've got this short little booklet. Why don't we just give it a try? I mean, Bergson's not nobody. We'll be reading someone who, you know, is probably worth reading. So we just give it a try, and it works out usually, like most of the time. Obviously, like I never like suggest anything to you that I haven't read myself, that is, because it could be worthless, right? Like it could just be like a worse. But the point is that, oh yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think you brought up a little bit of an interesting point, which is you said, is someone's worth reading? I think, too, a lot of who is worth, like, obviously there's just like crap out there, but there's also a lot of stuff that's like, there's many ways in which it could be interesting or it could be informative, and it's not necessarily always the intent of like the author in that kind of way, right? Like, I know we've read and gone through some, you know, for example, some pretty like out there political theory or whatever, which might be stuff that we very much like disagree with, or is on the face of it, someone could say, well, someone could say it's not worthwhile because it's, you know, it's wrong or it's hateful or it's problematic, whatever the, you know, the issues are. But still, sometimes engaging with that sort of work can also be informative for other reasons, right? Basically from the opposing view of seeing, getting to understand that sort of that critical assessment side, that critical reading. And like we've been able to do that a lot on the show as well. And that oftentimes is not something that gets to happen in school occasionally, but usually because as you said, like classes are so structured and have such a very specific timeline that they really want to hammer a really specific point in throughout the course of what the time that they have and the structure that they have. And, you know, they're not going to, not usually, you know, spend that time meandering down odd pathways and alleys of theory and thought,
Yeah, and I think the point, like, one of the important emphasis of school as well is, and I think of this, I think a lot of, like, not, like, early, maybe first year, but just, like, any class at all, even classes where you're, like, reading the Republic for the third time, a lot of it is a kind of practice at a text, right? Or, like, getting a certain work underneath your belt. Like, I would think of myself, I think... when I took not the first liberal studies class that I took, we weren't reading the Odyssey, but the first time I read the Odyssey in a liberal studies class, and I've read it multiple times, but that's another, I'll get to that in a second. But the first time I read the Odyssey, my idea of it was, okay, well, maybe it's not necessarily philosophy, but I'm getting a classic under my belt, right? And I've approached a lot of philosophy classes with that in mind. So, like, when I read, like, Beyond Good and Evil for the first time, I just considered it a part of my education to read this text and kind of get it under my belt, right? Because, like, what kind of, trained, educated philosopher would you be if you didn't encounter, you know, Nietzsche? Or if you didn't encounter, like, Heidegger, or if you didn't encounter Kant. So a lot of it just felt to me like, okay, this is part of the training. This is part of the education. This is just kind of like what you have to do to be considered like a well-read or like adequately read philosophy student, is to have these texts under your belt, understand them, at least have heard of them, and like, when someone asks you, you can say you've read them, even if you haven't, like, internalized them or something like that. But that goes to the point of what you're saying, where it's like, you know what? Like, why couldn't we? And we have. And I think it's a good, like, slight pushback against what I'm saying. It's not necessarily, like, you disagreeing with me, but it is, like, providing a counterexample. And it's an important one that, like, we've read stuff that isn't necessarily, like, quote-unquote worth reading, but it was still worth reading at the end of the day, right? Like, you know, kind of fringe ideas or things that we might not necessarily agree with at first, or stuff that is like unoriginal but the instance of it in its own time, you know, like those things you get to do here because you're not doing that educational work of getting classics under your belt, right? And I think that's kind of one other thing that is a feature of the show, is that I think, because this show was initially founded by an honors student who was Michael Robert Kaditz, and he was engaging with his peers at the time, and they would have been at like certain places in their education. But as it stands now that you and I are kind of doing the show more or less, but obviously we have other people who come on who have their own areas of expertise, there is kind of a certain degree where it's like, okay, we don't necessarily, like, we're not doing that educational work where we're just like teaching ourselves the things that we need to learn in order to like say that we're doing, you know, learning philosophy. We're kind of at a point where it's like, you've done the work, you've done the reading, now you get to do something with it in a way. You know, we get to go out and explore the things that you wouldn't necessarily like need to explore, but now that you've done those readings, you can check like, you know, minor texts or fringe ideas against like the classics, or, you know, weigh them in criticisms and stuff like that. And there's a certain degree of freedom to that too. And even I think like an extended sense of education to it as well, where it's like, this would even be useful for someone who was just like kind of starting out, but because of the way that school is structured, you couldn't accommodate like a whole classroom doing this. And I think like most students are like doing this on their own anyway, if they're really passionate about it. You know, they've got like their pet idea, or there's like something they've encountered that they're like reading along the way.
Well, I really think this show is, as you kind of said, that a lot of students are doing this on their own. I really think this show is reflective of students doing exactly that, you know, in many cases, us as students and the listeners as well. But it's just, you know, again, it becomes a vehicle for sort of, like you said, going past the free book pile or wandering through the library and picking out things that, you know, you might not otherwise encounter or you had heard about or you had in your more formal studies have been very lightly referenced. But, you know, it's not something you really hear about much. You hear about every day. But because there's so much freedom and flexibility, and because it's really like it's just about engaging with text for their own sake, we have the ability to do that, which is fantastic.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. I mean, I don't think, like, I remember a while back, I think this was even like as the pandemic was either winding up or winding down, I know that you and I, we went in to do live shows at CHLY, and one of the things that immediately kind of jumped out at us as far as like formats for doing this is that, hey, like when we read a text or we sort of encounter, you know, an essay or something like that, we send it to each other, we give it a read, and then we just sit down and we have a chat about it. But it's interesting to think that, like, that's not something that you necessarily have to do, because philosophy, you could also have, and I know that there are shows we've done previously, and they're still good shows, but just as a comment on the way that we're doing things now and what we find fruitful, philosophy is one of those things where you really could approach it just like topic-based. You don't necessarily need to have a text, but I think that just as far as talking about like what I get out of this and what I find valuable and what I hope the listener finds valuable is the opportunity to encounter and take seriously a text, whether it's a classic that we're re-exploring or exploring for the first time or something that we just found or even something that, again, like might not be something that anyone would read at all, but there's something that interests us in doing an episode about it and we share it and we discuss it. I do like the text focused sort of the text emphasis that we have. And I should say too that, again, going back to my encounter with liberal studies, I kind of snuck it in there a little bit there because that's how liberal studies is very much done. I wish that I guess I started doing that a little bit and like pushing wanting to do like text focused stuff because I wish that more philosophy classes felt like that. Even like you never go into a philosophy class where you're not reading a text because that's just how philosophy seems to be done in the West is it's very like textual, but it doesn't always feel like it doesn't always feel like everyone has the book open in front of them when you're discussing things. It can be, when you're doing philosophy, it's very easy to go into like a topic or to just generalize into an abstract exploration of a concept. I'm not like condemning it, but I'm just saying that for me, I seem to have a preference for like that textual kind of analysis because there's always something to come back to when a conversation goes somewhere. You can always sort of reground yourself and say, okay, this has been a great conversation and I'm sure that this text is saying that. Now let's try and square it with the text, or is this reading, you know, accurate or something like that. There's something about the textual way of doing things that I've really enjoyed doing.
Well, engaging with it, actually, this leads a little bit into the quandary that I had. As our listeners probably know, we do a little quote and quandary at the beginning. We've been having a little conversation this episode with y'all, so that's totally fine. There's the creator, and then there's the observers and the readers. It can be quite easy to read a text and think that you're getting the point and the idea and the general gist vibe, and it be pretty far off from what the author's intention was. Sometimes that's like every once in a while, that's actually probably a more interesting move, but a lot of times like it's simply misreading. Right. And so like when you're doing textual analysis, like going back, cycling it over, doing the, you know, continuing to interpret and reinterpret and really focus on it and bring it back, like have the focus be on the text itself, can definitely aid in having our own experience of the text be more reflective of the author's intent.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just keeps it, the text holds you responsible to what is being said, essentially, right? You can't just take an idea and misunderstand it for your own purposes, right? Like, I had this experience with Hannah Arendt's work, the one that I read all the time, The Life of the Mind, right? I mean, that's a book that I've been reading for a very long time, and it's a book that I feel like, almost because I haven't had too much of a, you know, of a hand helping me into it, I just kind of had it, you know, I kind of encountered it, and it was in the context of authenticity in an existentialism and literature class. We only read very, very short selections from it, and I was very stimulated by it. It was very exciting. I felt like something extremely important was going on in this work, and I didn't understand it at all. I thought that Arendt was like setting up a philosophy, like an ethics of authenticity, that Arendt was sort of trying to create like a moral naturalism by investigating the fact that as thinking beings, we have this other that is that sort of comes awake when we think, and this is the foundation of morality. It took me a very long time to just sort of encounter and then register very open statements where Arendt says things like, so yes, this investigation is me trying to eradicate all the categories and systems that philosophy has had from Plato up until now. You know, she says explicitly at the very beginning that philosophy is essentially dead, or at least philosophy as we know it. Also with Wittgenstein in a certain way, when people are reading Wittgenstein and they're saying that Wittgenstein is like developing some kind of epistemology or an ethics. Wittgenstein says that philosophy, at least the philosophy as you know it, is dead. He has this, I don't know exactly where it is in his journal, but famously he said, I destroy, I destroy, I destroy, and that he might only ever be remembered in the way that the people who burned down the Library of Alexandria were remembered, because he's destroying and laying down foundations for some new method of doing philosophy, right? This is not philosophy as you're used to it. But I think that goes to the point of why I misunderstood Arendt, and why maybe professional philosophers might be tempted to misread Wittgenstein, is because they kind of, and this goes back to the point of why it's important to use the text to hold you responsible to the author and to always have the text in front of you, is that we might actually have interests that we might want to support by misreading. So if I am searching for, say, authenticity, or I'm trying to search for like some kind of purpose or whatever, misunderstanding Arendt as espousing like an ethics of authenticity might actually be really useful for me. It might give me some kind of framework. It might soothe some kind of sore wound that I have as far as feeling like I need to be authentic. It might give me some framework. But it's not really what Arendt was talking about, right? Wittgenstein might give us some kind of framework for escaping the problems of philosophy. But, and I think he's trying to do that too. But if we're not careful, we might just end up replicating the same problems, right? Because we're just kind of seeing into it what we want to see.
He's very challenging. He's trying to do things in a really new way. You know, he's a real pioneer of philosophy of language. But also, too, I think the educational process really is a bit of chipping away, a bit of that. You know, we bring up many times the kind of the turning of the screw of interpretation, where it's like you get this very surface reading, which really is almost like just kind of more or less basic information, Sparks Notes, right? And then, you know, and then you go a little bit deeper and you get a little bit more into it. And then maybe you engage with secondary literature that's like, that's actually academic and important in and of itself, as an actual aid for continuing to turn the interpretive process. And that's like a